Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link. It's Thursday, the 19th of October, 2017. I'm Wanjiku Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are reporting to you live from Bonn in Germany.
In today's edition, questions continue to flow as to why the Gupta brothers in South Africa are not being investigated.
Why hasn't government done anything about the 500 million that has been paid to Trillion Capital? Why is there no forensic audit? Are you scared of the Guptas?
And protesters in Togo clash with the police hours after the government issued a ban on protests on weekdays.
We are seeing an increase in violence in Togo, and we are seeing also militias now being associated quite clearly to the security forces.
Plus, Somalia is putting itself together days after a deadly bomb blast that killed around 300 people. These stories and a lot more coming up shortly.
But first, let's hear what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Kenyan police have fired tear gas to disperse protesters on Thursday in capital Nairobi, as demonstrators allege police are using violence to crush opposition dissent ahead of a fresh presidential election scheduled for October 26. Human rights groups accuse sitting President Uhuru Kenyatta, who maintains he would continue campaigning, of using police to silence opposition supporters. Meanwhile, opposition leader Raila Odinga has said he would consider running in next week's presidential vote, but maintains that reforms within the Electoral Commission must be made for him to proceed.
If proper reforms are carried out, then we will consider. But as things stand right now, our position is as we announced it yesterday.
Spain's central government said it would consider suspending Catalonia's autonomy by invoking Article 155, a so-called atomic bomb, to protect the general interests of Spaniards, including the citizens of Catalonia, and to restore constitutional order. This came after Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont missed Spain's latest deadline and refused to budge from wanting to secede from Madrid. Puigdemont warned that Catalan's regional parliament could formally vote for independence should Madrid continue repressing the region. Several European leaders have met for a two-day summit in Brussels, where German Chancellor Angela Merkel and British Prime Minister Theresa May held talks over Britain's departure from the EU. Merkel said Brexit talks have made little progress so far, but said the second phase of negotiations could begin in December. Britain is expected to leave the EU bloc in early 2019. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Hundreds of people have donated blood for the victims of Saturday's terror attack in Somalia's capital Mogadishu, where a bomb blast blamed on Al-Shabaab militants killed around 300 people and wounded another 500. Hundreds of youth have assisted in search and rescue missions, while UN representative Rizadon Zeninga said over 100 of his UN colleagues donated blood.
Scale of the destruction is so huge. Hospitals are overwhelmed. They are running short of supplies. So we have called upon our colleagues in the UN family to donate blood.
Togo's security minister has announced that at least 5 people were killed and 60 arrested in clashes in capital Lomé and other cities after police fired tear gas to disperse anti-government protesters demonstrating for term limits for President Faure Gnassingbé, who has been in power since 2005 and whose family has ruled the West African nation since 1968. The opposition is demanding the reinstatement of Togo's original constitution, which they say would bar the president from a fourth term in 2020. And now in sports, a Bundesliga squad Bayern Munich have handed Scottish club Celtics a deafening blow last night, winning 3-0 at home and gaining 3 much-needed points in UEFA's Group B Champions League. Goals came from Thomas Müller, Joshua Kimmich and Mats Hummels. Müller is the first German player to score in 10 different Champions League seasons. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
Welcome back. I'm Wanjiku Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are live on Facebook. And for those of us who've already joined us, don't forget to leave us your comment and tell us where you are listening from.
Now, we start in South Africa, where state capture investigations against the rich Indian Gupta family intensify. It has emerged that not only are the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is investigating the Guptas in relation to suspicious cash flow between South Africa, Dubai, and America. The UK authorities are also investigating allegations that British banks recklessly acted as channels for money laundering linked to corruption in South Africa. This comes at a time when the South African Special Investigative Unit, the Hawks, has said that the Guptas are part of its investigations into state capture, while the country's parliament has already started grilling ministers and leaders of state enterprises on allegations they have helped the Gupta family in capturing the state. Tuzo Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The Financial Times says the FBI is investigating individuals, companies and bank accounts for ties with the Gupta family. Top on the list are suspicious cash flows from the Guptas in South Africa to Dubai and America. Today, members of parliament took the Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa to task on the issues of state capture when he addressed parliament. Floyd Chibambu, an MP from the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, wanted to know why the Gupta-linked companies are not being investigated for their alleged involvement.
Why hasn't government done anything about the 500 million that has been paid to Trillion Capital? Why is there no forensic audit? Are you scared of the Guptas?
And Ramaphosa, who has contradicted Zuma on a number of issues, including cabinet reshuffle, and now seeking to take over from Zuma, was clear and blunt in his response.
Any amount that has been paid out unduly should be returned and should be returned immediately. Now, those who are responsible in dispensing all these monies should be taken to book.
The FBI investigations come at a time when a string of leaked emails in South Africa show that the Guptas have had undue influence on President Jacob Zuma, his ministers, and leaders of parastatals, making millions of dollars in the process. A report by former public protector Tulma Donsela pointed out that President Jacob Zuma was at the center of the state capture, with testimonies that he consulted the Guptas for appointment of certain ministers. Zuma has, however, refuted those allegations. The Gupta family has also described the allegations as a political smear campaign against them. Ivo Chipkin from the Public-Based Research Institute at the University of Witwatersrand says there is only one solution to state capture.
If we treat the current phenomenon simply in terms of criminality, then we come up with a law and order solution, a policing solution. Arrest the Guptas, get rid of Zuma, and will somehow be resolved.
Many have welcomed the FBI investigations, saying it could give a hint on who has been involved and how much South Africa has lost in the process.
That was Tuso Kumalo reporting from Johannesburg.
And a quick response from Daily Terrence. He says, African leaders, I won't say much. Anyways, we are monitoring developments in Liberia, where the National Electoral Commission has announced that today it will come up with the official results from the presidential and parliamentary elections. Stay tuned. Our correspondent is down there monitoring what's going on, and we will bring you the updates as soon as we get that. We move on. Gangs of youth and security forces clashed sporadically in Togo's capital, Lomé, on Thursday before a planned opposition protest that the government had banned. The streets were largely deserted ahead of the rally, which the opposition coalition has refused to cancel. The demonstrators marched to the office of the ECOWAS, that's the West African bloc, to demand the resignation of President Faure Gnassingbé. Gnassingbé has been president since 2005, but the Gnassingbé dynasty has ruled Togo since 1968. Why hasn't there been much response from ECOWAS? A question I put to Gilles Yabi, founder of the West African citizens think tank, WATI.
I think ECOWAS has been following the situation and they published a statement with the UN and the African Union as well. The point to know is that ECOWAS is being chaired by Faure Gnassingbé, the president of Togo. It is certainly a difficult situation for the commission of ECOWAS to take strong position on this because the current chair of the organization is actually the person who is in the heart of this crisis, Togo.
So is it because of this personal relationship between President Faure Gnassingbé and the president of ECOWAS, that there hasn't been these unprecedented reactions in comparison to Gambia?
Yes, again, that is one of the factors, not just that it is a personal relation. It is the fact that, again, we are rotating chairmanship at ECOWAS, and the president of Togo is the current chair of the organization. And when you have the chair of the organization, the key people who make decisions in ECOWAS are the chair of the organization and then the president of the commission itself. The second thing is that the situation is quite different from that of Gambia. It is a very different situation politically. So, no one is talking about a military intervention of ECOWAS, for example, in Togo. It's a very different situation than what we had in Gambia, where a president lost an election and was refusing to leave.
The situation is currently simmering out of control. President Nasingbe hasn't hinted that he's going to leave power, and the protesters are also not going to give up. What's the way forward here?
It's very unpredictable. It's very difficult to know what, how the situation will evolve. We are seeing an increase in violence and repression also by the security forces in Togo. And we are seeing also militias now being associated quite clearly to the security forces to repress the demonstrators. So I think that the opposition feel that it is also time to continue the battle and to avoid what they actually experienced not only the last few years, but the last few decades.
Do you foresee this turning into a civil war? Because you just mentioned the interference there of civil forces, and now this is turning into not just protest anymore.
Well, I think that to have a civil war, you need some combination of factors that are not in place in Togo. And so I don't think that we are getting close to a civil war, but we are having, again, a lot of confrontation and a lot of violence. For now, the weapons are in the hand of the security forces and the military in the country.
Jill Siabi, founder of the West African think tank, WATI, we apologize for the poor quality of the telephone line.
And we do have a comment here from Isaac Ehoza Godwin, who says, I wonder why demanding for constitutional rights in many nations has become something that requires violence and bloodshed. Where has that true democracy gone, he asks. And another one from Muidin Olawuyi says, can't Africans solve their problems without violence? Togolese can vote him out through the ballot paper. Well, moving on to East Africa, Somalia is still gathering itself together after one of the country's worst attack in decades. The blasts in the heart of Mogadishu over the weekend killed over 300 people. But in the face of this disaster, the young people of Mogadishu have come together and taken a lead in the rescue efforts. Eunice Wanjiro brings this report.
Young Somalis have come together in a show of resilience after a weekend attack that killed over 300 and injured more than 500 people. Muna Mohammed is the coordinator of the Voluntary Youth National Rescue Team.
This is a national disaster which made the youth come out to share the pain of the nation. They are self-organized youth who are out to find a solution to this disaster. We have named ourselves the National Rescue Team.
The young people are gathered here in an act of patriotism, as Said Yusuf Ahmed, a volunteer from Jazeera University, says.
We are here from different universities and hospitals to take part in clearing the debris where the earth movers cannot reach. We are supporting our nation and sharing in the pain. We take satisfaction in helping our nation, and our role is to clear this rubble.
As the rescue and cleanup activities continue, Somalian President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed Farmajo has urged his countrymen to join the fight against the militia group Al-Shabaab.
That was DW's Eunice Wanjiru.
And a shout out to Ismael Kuroma, listening live from Sierra Leone, and Comrade Bin Afan from Damaturu in Nigeria.
Keep comments coming in. We are monitoring them.
You are listening to Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo.
And Wanjiko Mwaura, thanks for joining us live on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Coming up in this half of the show, the challenges of new university graduates in Liberia amid the country's presidential elections.
Unemployment is a serious issue, a mini in the situation of the youth. They are frustrated because once you learn, change is supposed to come. Every year, the university in Liberia increase their number of graduates.
And Zimbabwean police forcing vendors off the streets, plus your responses that we're monitoring on Facebook. Keep them coming.
But first, to our series, Why There Is Still Hunger in Africa. Let's go to Kenya, where aid organizations have warned that about millions of people in the East African country face threats of starvation as a result of the ongoing drought. Compared to South Sudan and Somalia, the two most affected countries, fewer people are acutely at risk. But the food crisis in Kenya has now even covered the middle class. Current food prices have risen to more than 100%. However, many people do not only blame the drought for the price hikes, but also the failure of government policies. Sela Oneko reports from Southern Kenya.
Dark clouds rise over Kisilu Mutsia's fields, but the farmer already doubts that this will bring the much-awaited rain. Three rainy seasons have already failed in southern Kenya, the home of Kisilu Mutsia and his wife Christine. Only a few beans have survived. Mutsia's entire maize crop, his main source of income, has dried up.
The other time I've been harvesting at least something to keep my family for 2 to 3 months. But now I'm investing almost nothing. Even it won't keep me for a week.
Farmer Mutsia was involved in a film project which started 7 years ago. He documents climate changes in his region. He has experienced a lot of weather extremes, droughts and floods. However, it has never been as bad as now. Instead of being able to sell his harvest, the farmer now has to go to the market to buy maize, the staple food for most Kenyans. But the portions he can afford are getting smaller and smaller.
I, as a farmer, I feel neglected because I'm ever struggling feeding my family, but government seems not to support us.
In the capital, Nairobi, the so-called maize crisis has been responsible for months of fierce political debates. Maize prices have now risen by more than 100%. The problem? The supposedly well-filled silos with emergency reserves were already empty shortly after the beginning of the drought. Did the maize rot or were they stolen? The Kenyan government responded by importing maize and launching a subsidy program to lower prices. But the whole system is thoroughly corrupt, says financial expert Ali Khan Sachu.
Folks are able to get access to those licenses and make seriously big and windfall profits at the expense, of course, of the rest of the country. Big windfall profits, and the theory is that a lot of this money circulates back into political spending.
From the outset, the government has done its best to counter the food shortage in the country, says James Odwor, director of the National Drought Management Agency.
The president declared drought a national disaster, and he called upon all the other stakeholders to join hands and support the government. So anybody who is interested in helping should join hands and help now. But those people who are not interested in helping, they should shut up, not talking everywhere nonsense.
But farmer Kisilu Mutsia has long ceased to rely on politics in Nairobi. Together with other small farmers, he wants to install a self-made irrigation system on their fields. The plant has not worked quite as well as they hoped. Nevertheless, a few tomatoes are already growing. And perhaps, the farmers hope, they can again cultivate their own maize next season.
Not yet. I'm just some minutes.
Sela Oneko with that report from Southern Kenya. Just to remind you that this is a series that began here on Africa Link on Monday. Yesterday, we had one on Nigeria and how the Boko Haram insurgency is causing food crisis in the northeast of the country. People have been responding to this, Wanjiko.
Yes, David from Nigeria writes in and says, Nigerian politicians don't really care about the lives of the citizens. All they care for is their own family. That has been a big problem in Nigeria since the 1970s.
We have Uche Chi De Bere Joe, pardon me there for that difficulty, asks who is safe and who is feeling well in Nigeria. Well, I think he's referring to the elites who enjoy a much safer and better standard of living.
Yes, indeed.
Speaking out.
Now, we head to Zimbabwe, where rights groups and activists are speaking out against the police who are violently trying to disperse vendors in Harare, the capital city. The vendors have vowed to remain put, saying that they have nowhere to go since the unemployment rate is above 85% in Zimbabwe. DW's Columbus Mavunga in Harare has been following the story.
Those are informal traders in Harare seeking attention of potential buyers. They are selling things like herbs, second-hand clothes, fruits, vegetables, music CDs, or anything that you can think of. They are defying this order from President Robert Mugabe.
Roads must be left free for the cars to run. We must clear the roads. We don't want to see the Nigerian style. Harare must be the smartest of all towns because it's our capital city.
The police has been violently chasing the informal traders away. But the moment police leave, it is back to business. One of them is Samuel Wadzai, the director of the Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation, and he's saying he's staying put in the streets.
We are resisting because we feel it's not fair. We are in the streets not because we want to be there. We are trying to look after our families. The government has failed to provide employment for the majority of this country. And we are in the streets because we are trying to look after our families. We are trying to survive in these harsh economic circumstances. So for the president to come out and then say we should leave the streets, it's not fair. And we don't expect that to be coming from him. We will resist. We will continue to operate from where we are.
But it's not only President Mugabe who wants Zimbabwe's streets cleared of vendors. Serenity Mgodo lives in Harare and supports the president's order.
It is better to take them off the streets, as people were now finding it difficult to move freely. The vendors must be put in places which are not busy.
Another one is Sylvester Simango.
If it's the central business district, they should be allocated places to sell their wares so that they do not block roads for vehicles to move. Even us pedestrians, there are times we get into town and we find no places to walk. So since there are no jobs, I see it as a nice thing to get them a place to do their informal trading.
While businesses and other Zimbabweans applaud President Mugabe's call for clampdown on vendors, rights groups are worried by the high-handedness of the police. They say dispelling them contravenes the informal traders' economic rights enshrined in Zimbabwe's constitution.
That is DW's Columbus Mavunga in Harare.
And we are still monitoring situations in Liberia, where the National Electoral Commission is about to announce the outcome of the general elections.
Uzon.
Now, speaking of Liberia, after 14 years of peace since the end of its civil war, the country is still challenged with high youth unemployment. Outgoing President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, in her 2005 inauguration speech, promised to provide 20,000 new jobs. As her regime nears completion, this promise has remained elusive for the young people who make up 65% of Liberia's 4.1 million people. The youths are frustrated, especially graduating from university and cannot get formal employment. Most of the country's youth are voting in these elections with the hope that a new government will stop the problem of youth unemployment. Iblim Kade reports.
Every day, Ivy Tanu finds himself here on Broad Street in Liberia's capital, Monroeville, where he sells mobile phones. Since he graduated from the university with a bachelor's degree in economics in 2013, the 32-year-old is yet to get a formal employment. He has since relied on petty trade to make ends meet.
I am highly disappointed. 2011, at the time having graduated from college, the president of the Republic of Liberia promised to employ more youth. In her inauguration speech, she said that you are going to get 20,000 jobs a year. And upon my graduation up to now, I haven't getting employment, whether government or private sector, to be formally employed.
And what makes matter worse for this college graduate is the decline in his sales.
When I first started this business, it was much more encouraging than now. For the past 2 years, it has been very bad. Tremendously, sales have dropped. What I used to sell, like selling 4 a day, it is not difficult to even have sell 2 a day. So that is the difficulty we are faced with.
The stories of many college graduates seeking employment many years after their graduation is alarming. The hope of students here at the state-run university getting a job after they complete studies here is their greatest nightmares.
Series of leaders have come to this particular country. They have promised people that say they are going to create a job, they are going to make a job.
Solomon Pay is a lecturer here at the University of Liberia teaching statistics. For him, it is even more frustrating, molding the minds of youths who cannot get jobs after their studies.
Unemployment is a serious issue, a mainly in the situation of the youth. They are frustrated because once you learn, change is supposed to come. Every year, the university in Liberia increase their number of graduates. I ask them, oh, there is no job. I have tried. Since I graduated, I have gone through the process. I applied so. I can't find my way through, so I just decided to even bring my core. I decided to do this.
For Ivan, the unavailability of employment opportunities for young people is entirely blamed on Sally's failure in properly implementing her policies.
Or promising the same thing is another thing in implementing. We got Google laws, but we are not implementing them. So till they come to perform, that when I will greet them, but I still have a big question about who become president of this state.
Many youths say Nobel Peace Prize laureate and Africa's first woman president failed in providing the 20,000 jobs she had promised. As Liberia bids farewell to her, young people say they want a new president that can create job opportunities for them.
Evelyn Pade in Monrovia, and Evelyn is currently at the NEC headquarters trying to get the results there. If we do not get that information, we'll definitely leave it on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
And now we also ran a follow-up after Somalia's tragic disaster last weekend. And someone did comment on this. Yusni Omer from Cameroon, reminding us of this attack, says, on Saturday, more than 300 people were killed in one of the deadliest terrorist attacks in decades. But the world barely paid attention. It didn't happen in London or New York or Paris. So there were no trending hashtags showing support with Mogadishu.
Umar continues to say it's unclear if Facebook activated its safety check feature when international media covered the story. It was buried far beneath the headlines. The lesson, of course, is that we elevate some human lives above others. It's repulsive and immoral. We can stand with Somalia too.
And it's been very encouraging to follow up on this story on how the young people have come out in huge numbers in the clear up and rescue efforts in Somalia.
Definitely. And another story we also checked out for our social media section is the unveiling of the new Nelson Mandela autobiography, should I say that? He didn't finish it.
But he wrote most of the book himself.
Yeah, he didn't. And then there was a comment here. Well, Nelson Mandela didn't actually finish the book himself. It was completed by someone else, right?
Yes.
We monitor that story, for sure.
And Fanuel Kakoshi says, Mandela was an icon, laid a firm foundation for South Africa, an epitome of democracy. Well, very huge praises there for Mandela and his role of democracy in South Africa.
Yeah. A final comment here from Rene Gires, Southern Cameroon, says, well, we haven't had internet since October. First. That's a story we'll definitely monitor that.
And NVT on our Facebook page says a lack of strong institutions in Africa is the main cause of political instability. It's time for Africans to step up.
Thanks all for your responses. That's all we had time for. I am Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Onjiko Mwaura.